Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Golden State Killer, East Area Rapist, Original Night Stalker, Visalia Ransacker, and more. The story of the Golden State Killer's beginnings. Who else was he as he traveled through time? Is he the Zodiac Killer who terrorized us in the 1960s and who sits in the Sacramento County Jail awaiting trial? Ann Penn presents evidence of other monikers that belong to this man, spanning the almost six decades the killer roamed the state of California. The career and possible monikers for the same man, 1960 to 2018. This is the true story of how such a man remained free all of those years. This is the true story of the man's patterns and attacks from the beginning until the end. The story continues. The most prolific serial criminal in California history. He could be the most prolific serial killer ever. He could not be stopped until DNA and genetic genealogy found him. What if this is truly how the story goes? Anne has written about the possibilities and writes about things no one else has mentioned in the Zodiac story. The book that we're featuring this evening is What If? Golden State Killer, Zodiac Solve, with my special guest, journalist and author, Anne Penn. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Anne Penn.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Again, the story continues of one of the most fascinating cases in true crime history. First off, why this book? What if? What's the purpose of this book?
To try to shed light on how far back the crimes of this particular man may go. And that he was an expert at evading capture and used law enforcement tactics against us, against the community and against the people that he hurt.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. As we're going to talk about this, you said that this was a common assumption that possibly once especially D'Angelo was arrested for the East Area Rapist, Original Night Stalker, Golden State Killer crimes, that especially people were saying, is there a link? Could he possibly be the Zodiac? This was not just your idea. So
no.
From there, why did you undertake to show, to prove, to state the case that they're one and the same?
Well, I actually never started out to end up here.
Right.
The original purpose for the book was, excuse me one second, the original purpose for the book was to just try to look at what other murders D'Angelo may have committed, what the patterns of attack were, what areas he was in, because now we knew by looking at, you know, where he lived and what he was doing, what was going on in his life, what he may have done. And as you start to look into that, I mean, it goes, anybody who knows anything about serial killers, of course, knows that they didn't just happen to start killing in their 30s. They probably started committing crimes when they're 15, you know, or when they're teens. And so you go back to, like, maybe 1960. In his case, he was about 14, almost 15 that year. And you start to see where he may have been, you know, what was going on. And as you do that, and it took quite a while, really, to sort of peel back all the different, you know, scenarios and different opportunities he had, timelines, the geography. You start to see where, in the beginning of the book, I talk about the dog poisonings, which I, you know, was talking to a gentleman about who research that in depth. And the reality is we know that D'Angelo hated dogs, and he was arrested in 79 with dog repellent and a hammer. And so if you go back to the area he grew up in, what you see is a bunch of dog poisonings in the Placer area, which is in California, Northern California. And you see this pattern emerge where there are dog killings, 16 sometimes, 10, huge numbers of animals being killed with strychnine, and then there'd be burglaries. And you can see that in not only that area, but in different areas that he traveled over time, there would be a rash of dog poisonings, and then a bunch of burglaries and other types of crimes. So you can see something's going on.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating, too, that you did that work and followed certain areas from where he was living at one point, Exeter, and showed also and told also, because you're a California native, tell us the advantage you have from living in California as opposed to somebody else looking at this from afar, especially, because you say geography is a huge reason why he was free for all those years and is a huge element in this story.
Right. Yeah, because I really do think that he was very aware of the county lines everywhere he went. He knew where the jurisdictions began and ended. He knew that he could hit in one place, travel an hour if he wanted to, and hit someplace else. I mean, there's one instance in the book where he was in one place that we can see raping somebody and drove another hour or two away, and the same thing happened within the same 12-hour period. And so, you know, and of course we can't prove that it's him because nobody kept rape kits or slides or any of that because of the statute of limitations. But if we did have that information, we could actually prove what his travels were, what jurisdictions he did hit in, because when you look at the archives, the historical information, you can see, you know, different patterns where he would kill dogs and move. He would, you know, create all kinds of havoc and do all kinds of terrible things, and then he'd move up the road. And this continued, you know, for decades. So that's what the pattern is. And I do have to acknowledge, too, that the dog poisoning articles were given to the public domain and also to a gentleman that helped me investigate those things, and he was very instrumental in that. His name is Paulie, and I hesitate to say that because I don't have his permission, but I call him Sam in the book. But I want to make sure he has some acknowledgement for all the hundreds and hundreds and thousands of hours that he put into this. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, what was that collaboration? What else did it entail, that collaboration? Because you say this is, again, instrumental, this collaboration. So what else did this person bring to this, other than just a sounding board and a fellow researcher?
Well, he was looking at our news articles, and we were sharing information back and forth. And the reason that I think that we collaborated so well was because, in his own words, he said, "You're the only one who can see what I see." And I'm sure that there are other people that will be able to see it, but it needed to be told in a fashion where people are not overwhelmed with information. Because he couldn't have committed every crime in the state of California. He couldn't have committed every murder or rape. We know this, but we want to know which ones he did commit. And so when you study a criminal in depth, there are certain ones that you absolutely know he had to have something to do with. So those kinds of things law enforcement are interested in, of course, because there are so many unsolved murders of women, especially in the state of California from 1963 on, and also couples. So.
You provide the background that I think was new for me to read about Joseph D'Angelo Sr. and the Hamilton Air Force Base and Van Nuys and Kathleen, his mother, and the four children. And also him being in Folsom High School. We're well aware of that from your other two books, Murder on His Mind and Creep Among Us. Tell us about the Navy And again, he's what age when he goes into the Navy from high school, and there are personal events, interactions with women that are obviously shaped what happened to him later on in his crime life. Tell us a little bit about the background that you provide in this book that was crucial to understanding his mindset and development of this potential or this future serial killer, pardon me.
And also the geography of where he was. Now, everybody that studies these crimes, every sleuth that's out there already knows that he went in the Navy when he was about 18. He dropped out of high school to go into the Navy. And this was not too terribly long after his parents were divorced. And I think that that really was his trigger. Not so much the situation with Bonnie later on, but and that was a catalyst for him to act out more. When Bonnie, his girlfriend that he had in 1970, dropped him in 1971. But I really think that when he really was triggered to, you know, really go after all these terrible things was when his parents were divorced. And his father was stationed in the area, in the Bay Area, Novato and Van Nuys. And, you know, he probably knew from being with his dad that area to a certain extent. And I wondered, how much did he know about it? Did he go to Lake Berryessa when he was a kid? He knows California. He knows California in a way that somebody who has traveled it, you know, intimately knows it. And so he knew, you know, what he could do and where he could do it, and then he would move on. And he did change MOs. So
what's interesting, and I think we will have to talk about this later to put it in context, that you provide some startling information that really does dispel this idea that serial killers, according to profiles, can't change MOs, don't change MOs. I don't think they say it, they're saying it unequivocally. They just provide that this is what the profile says. You have some startling information based on those rape kits that inadvertently you get this incredible information that certainly supports your MO theory.
Yeah. And well, what's interesting about a lot of people don't think that this man could possibly have been the Zodiac because he didn't rape the women. Or they think that he can't possibly be that guy because he was somewhere else. Some, you know, they have all kinds of ideas that he can't possibly be him. And one of them is his MO. And the MO that he changed over time, we know that he was Visalia ransacker. We know that there were a lot of crimes committed even before then in the 60s in Sacramento area where he came from in Folsom, where there were rapes and there were other things that were occurring. And he was smart enough to know when to move on. And, you know, it's not a far stretch of the imagination to realize that when he got out of the Navy, that he knew the Bay Area. He, you know, didn't have school yet to go get his criminal justice degree. He didn't know Bonnie yet, but he was angry. And so, you know, it's not a far stretch of the imagination to realize that he could have started in, I say, 1963, down on the beach at Lompoc, and then continued on. And each time you see him do something, and then he leaves. So we know that in, like, 1964, he went in the Navy. So in Lompoc, the crimes that were committed down there against couples who were killed, that was in 1963, 1964, all of a sudden we see him vanish. He went in the Navy, and nothing terrible happens again for a while. So you can track him geographically and with a timeline, and the only thing that I don't have is DNA proof of this. What I have is, you know, his geographical profile, his MO, his timelines, and, you know, every time there's a crime committed, you find that he was available for that crime. Or, you know, so that's, you know, you just kind of follow what goes on and then figure out that, you know, it really could be him. So there's no reason that he couldn't change his MO. He told the whole world when he was Zodiac, and like I said, I'm saying alleged Zodiac, alleged Golden State Killer. He, you know, he's not been proven guilty in a court of law.
Wow.
These are theories, And it's actually circumstantial evidence of him being in an area of these things happening, and there are patterns, there are clusters, and it continues over time and space, decade after decade.
You provide...
And like I said...
You provide is a woman that you say that was stalked, and she provided all of this, these bits of evidence, pieces of evidence, eventually. But her rebuffed initially by law enforcement in the county where she was. She contacted you. You hooked her up with, again, tell us the story and what this tells you and in support of your theory of much earlier crimes.
This is an anonymous woman because I don't have her permission to write her story. I don't know if she will eventually, but the thing that D'Angelo did in general is that he would stalk people. He would peep. He would, you know, keep showing up. There's evidence that in the Farron murders that there was somebody that knew her, had come into her place of employment. There was also evidence at Betty Lou Jensen's house where somebody was out there peeping. The gates were left open. Who does that sound like? It sounds like the East Area rapist. He would peep. He would stalk. He would, you know, go and leave gates open and just sort of try to terrorize people. The patterns are really similar and or the same over and over again. So those are the things you have to look at when you're considering evidence of more monikers that he may deserve. So this particular woman did finally realize when the East Area rapist was arrested that she actually knew him. She had never seen her stalker. He stalked her for years and years and years and kind of followed her from one place to another and left items in her home and just terrorized her in general, would make phone calls. So this went on for, you know, like 20 years or more, actually. It was until 2017 at least. And she didn't realize that she actually had known him at one point as a cop. And when she saw who it was when they arrested him and said his name, she just sat down and cried. So, but she had contacted me, and we spoke for 7 or 8 months at least and discussed, you know, some of the things that went on. And people are interesting because they contact me, and like one of the other ladies who spoke in my other book, Dr. Sue Barrett, she had the East Area rapist come into her home in 1983 in the attack zones in Sacramento after everyone had said that he left. And and when she told her story on Facebook, she was starting to take quite a beating from people saying, I don't believe anything she said. And I didn't know her from Adam, and I just said, I believe every word she says because it is totally him. And he did continue to do what he wanted to do in Sacramento after 1980 when they thought he was gone. And as we know, he was sitting right there, had purchased a home just down the street. So, and he sat there for the next 30 years. So he didn't stop. He never stopped anything that he was doing. He just changed it up. And if you see that pattern and he knows what to do to get out of a place within 15 minutes to a half hour, law enforcement will show up, takes him a while to get there. He knows how to go, how to get out, and how to not get caught. So
why, as many people would ask, why the Zodiac, why such a dramatic change in MO? What would be the, again, you just mentioned there's a reason for it to shake up law enforcement. He is a law enforcement, had graduated with a criminal justice degree, so at least he believes that he's smarter than law enforcement, and he's proved that to himself with crimes progressively from a young age, various crimes as well. So he thinks he's quite
right.
Yeah, he's proved it.
Yeah.
But why why the Zodiac, and then again explain. Why that? Why such a dramatic difference? Why a mask, a disguise? You also talk about that you have evidence of him using disguises, which reinforces why maybe,
right.
Again, a completely different persona.
There was even, Yeah, that's true. And what's interesting is he actually did use wigs, and he did use disguises, and he did change it up, and he did everything you can think of better and more than anybody else I've ever studied, and I've studied a lot of serial killers. But the reason that he, you know, if in fact it's proven beyond reasonable doubt that he is also deserving of the moniker Zodiac, one thing is he was able to be in that area. And people don't understand in California how close Auburn is to the Presidio, for example, in San Francisco. They don't understand how he could attack and leave and go to Vallejo, for instance, from Lake Herman. It's really not that far away. He could vanish easily because he typically had some place to go. And he got the heck out of there. But the thing that happened with the Zodiac murders is that after he took out a few couples, the outlier for me was the Paul Stein murder. And after that attack, we do know that someone saw him and gave a composite. And so he knew that it was time to move on. And he probably was going to anyway, because he went to school after that. He came back to Auburn, went to school, got his degree, all that other stuff happened. So he knew that if somebody saw him, who cares? He was out of there. And so he sent a note. He said, "I shall no longer announce to anyone when I commit my murders. They shall look like routine robberies, killings of anger, and a few fake accidents, etc. The police shall never catch me because I have been too clever for them." And this was a communication was received, I believe it was November 9th, and the postmark was November 8th. Which is ironically D'Angelo's birthday, and he was gone. And then what's to keep him from changing up his routine? And that's what I think he did.
You provide evidence too that there are some things that he says. There are some the way he says certain things, and sort of the motivation seems beyond coincidence between the Zodiac and the East Area Rapist, especially when you can consider the taunting and the messages. It's not exactly the same, but it seems like from, as you explained, from the same person.
Right. Yeah, some of the things he said about going to Mexico or Bakersfield, different things that he just said. He didn't take money. He just wanted to kill them. When it came to the Zodiac. And the same thing occurred with the East Area Rapist over and over again. He would say the same kind of things. "Oh, don't worry, I'm not going to hurt you." And then he would, you know, not really steal anything of value. He would steal one earring or one, you know, one thing, a piece of jewelry. So it was consistent throughout with some of the things that he said, as both, all the monikers, really.
You also talk about some of the things that the patterns that you noticed in terms of names that he seemed to like and seemed to, again, very much like the Zodiac, but in a fairly earlier incarnation of playing games. And you talk about these word games, name games. Tell us a little bit about the patterns that you discovered regarding this.
Well, what's interesting is that I talked to the different people that I was investigating this with, and it was something that I noticed over and over because I'm a detailed person when it comes to the street names, the names of the murder victims, and different things like that. Even the fact that when he killed Paul Stein, he asked him to take him to Maple in Washington, and then when they arrived there, he asked him to go another block up to Cherry Street. And that's where he walked away on Cherry Street after he tore the shirt from Paul Stein. And some of the things that you see, he was on the Navy ship Piedmont, and one of his attacks in Sacramento was Piedmont and Seamus, and right off of Riverside, and Riverside is a connection to him geographically with his family. He liked Cherry Glen. He attacked many times in that area, in the Sacramento area. He killed more than one Sherry. He, Sherilyn, Sherry, Cheryl, Charlene. It's over and over again in the patterns from the Zodiac and from the East Area Rapist, original Night Stalker. The name Taylor, Taylor Street, Eva Taylor. Taylor is all over the place in these different wanderings. So, you know, there's more. I mean, Blue Rock, Blue Ravine, there's different places that he went. and appear to like to gravitate to. And I really do think one of the things that was a game he played with himself, because
right.
he thought he was smarter than everybody else and no one would figure it out. And they didn't.
Right,
so,
right.
Yeah.
You write about Charlene and Gerald Gallego operating
uh-huh.
in Sacramento. Again, you lived in Sacramento.
Right.
Talking about many serial killers talk about sex slaves, but you don't really write about this, but I'm just curious. You must have stumbled across some of this anyway. Do you really think that, do you think Gallego was an influence in how D'Angelo operated, especially in regards of trying to avoid, apprehension?
Yeah, I think a couple things probably happened. One is that they were operating right off of Highway 80. They're not far from where D'Angelo worked as a cop in Auburn between 78 and 80. And he knew they were there. He knew they're, sort of harsh in his gig, as they say, so to speak, because that was a serial killer. And as far as law enforcement was looking at the East Area Rapist as just a rapist. And so they were totally looking for a serial killer, and that was Gerald Gallego. So he was dumping bodies right not too far down the road and in the same areas that D'Angelo did. And so I think probably that was one of the reasons he probably kind of laid low after 1978 because in that area because of that. And we see him stop attacking after the Maggiore murders in February of 78, and then we see him off of Seamus and Piedmont in 78 in April. And then he sort of doesn't do anything again that we can track until March of 79 in East Sacramento. And most people don't talk about that attack. It was almost like, he left in 78 in April after the composites came out after the murders of the young couple. And one of the things I thought about, because he did kill couples over and over again, and I think he liked to read about his crimes. He liked to see burglaries or what things popped up in the newspaper. He also probably saw announcements for weddings, engagements, and that kind of thing. And it's entirely possible in my mind that he didn't accidentally run into the Maggiore couple on February 2nd, 1978. He could have stalked them. He could have decided he was going to take them out the same way that some of the couples were shot in other areas over time, and it was maybe an intentional murder. So that's something that I just recently thought about, because the pattern of killing couples via stabbing, shooting, however he did it, that was one of the things that he did do. I mean, this couple's out walking in the dark, walking their dog. How is it they just accidentally run into this guy? So I think that there might be more to that story.
Well, you provide some interesting information, too, with the Bonnie Cowell, and then you talk about an arson. So tell us about this goes way back. So, and when you also talked about, you said he was angry, but angry about what?
Mm-hmm. Well, in 1979, as we know, he was arrested in the areas of attack off of Greenback in Citrus Heights area, Sacramento County, for stealing. Allegedly stealing, and then that day they had the time through the chair, that's how the story is, to wait for law enforcement. Well, they didn't arrest him. All this time I had thought they actually arrested him, took him downtown, whatever. And I read some more about that, and I realized that they just cited him. There was a citation, and they let him go. And so I thought, there's got to be something where he was really angry that day, that night, because he was arrested for shoplifting. He had to be in a huge rage. And as I was reading some archived information about a particular arson, I was looking for that date, which was in July of 1979. And that night of that day that he was arrested, we find him, again, this is all speculation because I cannot prove an arson and I cannot prove that this was him, but here's what happened. There was a home that was burglarized first. After they tried to burn it down, they could see that there were where the things that had been removed had been. They could see that somebody took things. And what happened was this house was actually burned to the ground, and it was in Penryn, California. Now, anybody who's from here knows that Penryn is just down the highway from Auburn, California, which is not far from where D'Angelo lived and worked. And this house burned to the ground, and it was on the corner of Caldwell Street. And Bonnie Caldwell, as we know, was one of the people in this story. And so I found that interesting that that was a street name, and that was where her parents lived in Penryn. It seems like too much of a coincidence to me. So,
is there any indication why Bonnie Caldwell broke up with D'Angelo a year after their, about a year into their relationship? Was there any indication why, or any indication what she thought of him?
Well, there's the story that she tells actually on Man in the Window. And I haven't listened to the whole series. I was busy doing this book and researching these other things. And so I haven't listened to the whole thing. But what I heard was that she, he didn't like to follow the rules. He wanted her to give him notes on a particular class and also cheat for him on a test. And she said, no, she wouldn't do it. He was a lot of times doing things where he was pushing the boundaries, and she wasn't comfortable with that at all. She knew that the rules didn't apply to him. And so she decided that it really probably wasn't a good idea to marry him. And that's pretty much what I know in a nutshell about why she was right in her gut instinct that maybe he wasn't the guy for her. And then also he showed up after she broke it off with him with a gun. And so I talked about that a little bit in my book, because it would have been, back in the day, people didn't talk about things like that. And all that her father wanted for Joe to do was to go away and leave Bonnie alone. And so he talked him down and made him go away. And he didn't want to ruin his plans for a career in law enforcement, so he didn't call the cops on him, and he didn't report that he showed up at the house with a gun. And so D'Angelo wandered away. And but that what's interesting is that her family didn't ever seem to recognize any of the newspaper articles later on that this might be the guy that's, you know, got a problem.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting too. And you said too that, you know, the father must have had this delicate balance too, the saying, listen, you know, I'm not going to call the cops. You know, in those days, I don't know if everybody handled everything with the police anyway. But it was interesting because he must have made this bargain in that you go away and I don't say anything, you leave my daughter alone, kind of. But it really was definitive like that, like go away. And so he did.
Yeah. Yeah. He knew Joe wanted to be, originally, I think his plan was to be a California Highway Patrol. And that way, I'm sure he could have committed all kinds of crimes, you know, out on the road. But that didn't happen. He decided to be a cop instead. So, yeah.
Now, I think maybe I said we'd talk about this later, but I think this is such a compelling thing in terms of supporting your change of MO. I mean, I've never seen anything this, again, radical. Tell us about the rape kits and the warehousing and the backlog and the myths that we might think about rape kits. We talked about statute of limitations. There's a reason why a lot of these things weren't tested, but as you write in the book, tell us.
Well, you know, as they've been studying things, and I find it really interesting that it's taken this long for an article such as this to come out, but it was an excellent article about how, you know, a lot of people have been hearing about how they warehoused rape kits and they didn't test them, and they were in rat-infested warehouses and with broken windows and all kinds of fun stuff. And what they found out, so they started to finally test them, and they've had funding to do that in different states, is they're finding out that the patterns are, lo and behold, and of course most women would go, duh, but, and I don't mean to be disrespectful, but the reality is that they always, a lot of times in law enforcement, would assume that the rape victim would know her attacker. And if she didn't know her attacker, then they wouldn't test the kit, or they wouldn't put a lot of energy into solving the crime. So these tests these rape kit tests just sat there. They didn't ever test them. And what they started finding out as they tested them is that it wasn't just usually an acquaintance that that the perpetrator would rape. He actually would go out and rape other women that he didn't know. Over and over and over, decade after decade, they found that there were serial rapists who, those kits, if they'd been tested after the first woman he raped, then would have some information about that guy and could have stopped him because he became a serial rapist. And it was decade after decade that had the same perpetrator. and they said, oh, my God, these guys don't just rape people they know. They rape anybody. And they do it over and over and over. And that's why I said, duh. Because, yeah, of course, if somebody's going to rape someone, why would they not do it again if there's no consequences? Nobody tests the rape kits. And so it's they had, you know, they could do whatever they wanted. But what they're doing is they're testing them now, and they're putting these guys in jail, which is great. But they also, they ended up, what was I going to tell you? They had different perpetrators that, like I said, if they tested it right off the bat. And what happens then, too, this is what I was going to tell you, is serial killers are not just born all of a sudden. They start out a lot of times as serial rapists, and then they become serial killers because maybe somebody sees them or whatever it is that they have to up the ante, they have to up the adrenaline, whatever it is. And so serial rapists become serial killers sometimes. And that's one of the things I would have thought was logical progression.
Yeah, but you also say, too, that it took an incredible effort in Ohio and Cleveland. Like you say, most of these convictions, when you look at the conviction rate, once they did do that testing, again, how far, what was the impetus for them to have to do the testing in the first place? Well, a serial killer like Anthony Sowell in Cleveland. So some of these tests and governors got involved because that makes them look good, or it's a great idea. But you say most states aren't really participating, or they don't have the conviction rates, and you provide the reasons for that as well. So when it looks like a great story that's finally come to bear, that, wow, that they're finally doing something. Again, you talked about the efficiency of it too. When they catch serial rapists, it's conclusive and it's cost effective, and compared to other forms of investigation.
Yeah, because it's going to ultimately save them money in the long run, because they've cut down on crime, they've gotten rid of the perpetrators off the streets, and it just makes sense all the way around. So.
Yeah, it's good investigation in terms of time spent, and then the certainty of that evidence that you get, rather than following leads. It's incredible the difference in manpower and how much time you would save doing this. So, again, you write about that there's not the will, and the Obama administration put some money towards this, and then, of course, those certain states that want to participate, but you say there isn't really as much cooperation as you might have thought. It was a surprise to you.
Well, actually, yeah. I mean, everything is just a little bit slower to move along and to progress, like anything that, you know, when you want something to change, it takes time. And, you know, people have been talking about in one of my other books, I think from the first one and also in the second one, I talk about the rape kit testing and the website that's out there regarding that, that Mariska Hargitay put together.
Right.
So, you know, it's one of those things that's been talked about for quite some time, you know, more than a decade. Geez, I don't even know exactly when it started to become something that people reported that these kits were in warehouses and not being tested. Thousands, and I mean, a couple hundred thousand across the United States. It's insane.
Let's talk about what
go ahead.
Sorry. Let's talk about how the startling information that was derived from that, I say inadvertently, but from this rape kit testing, from the somewhat surprising idea that these were serial rapists now, and so they could make convictions based on that. What also was startling was the support that these guys changed their MO. So certainly they had those investigative reports, you looked at that supported your idea that people could change their MOs readily. and do.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and what's interesting is they do learn from one another, and I mean, that I had originally said in the Murder on His Mind that I thought this killer learned from maybe Ted Bundy or whatever, or maybe he was paying homage to him or something. But the reality is that they really do learn as they go. And back in the day, if you think about it, the term serial killer hadn't even been said until I think it was the 70s. And
right.
Then what we're trying to figure out really what makes them tick and how they operate. And a lot of the time, people think, like in this story, a lot of people actually will think that he, the story goes exactly how it's been told, which is he started out as the Visalia ransacker, he was the East Area rapist, he was the original Night Stalker, and that was all. And he operated from 73 to 86, and then he quit. And some people believe that. But the reality is that most serial killers start way before we even know about them, and they don't stop until you catch them or they die, or they're in, you know, that's pretty much it. They just don't stop. And even if it was just cutting back to prowlings and peepings and you know, whatever, there was an instance of a woman, Susan Jacobson, in Roseville, California, who's vanished into thin air from a Raley's parking lot in, did I say 2003? And it's in the attack zone areas and not far from where D'Angelo lived. And it's never been solved, and we've never seen her again. So, you know, things happen to people. And if a man is strong, even if he's over 50, he can still take advantage of opportunities to do what he does. So I have to also mention, too, that Dr. Susan Barrett also was somebody who was looking at this with me along the way after we met online. And I believed her story about having this guy show up in her home, and actually came back as well, and they saw him at the time in 1983. She also looked into these things as well, and she brought forth to Pastor Bill, sheriffs in the DA's office, the Granite Spring murders of Sherilyn Hockley and Cindy Wanner, as well as, and they're looking into that. And then also, because they were murdered in 1991 and 1993, and also there's another couple in Orangevale. And so different things happened over time. And, you know, there was nobody stopping them. So.
What about when you talk in the beginning of the book about, again, I'm not sure the pronunciation. Is it GED Match? Is it GED Match? What's the name of the genealogy company?
I think you can go with either one. Yeah. GED Match is what a lot of people say.
You talk about the, in light of the arrest, there were some changes to the genealogy site itself, and there were obviously is a controversy about, again, privacy. Tell us what your ideas are about that and what those changes are, and again, your idea about the usefulness of these kinds of sites. Tell us what you think.
Well, I think that one of the reasons it took so long to finally, you know, download the profile and get the results and find the guy is because they were trying to figure out how to do it because of privacy issues. Ancestry was not allowing, I don't think, for them to look, you know, just go in there and just carte blanche look. So it's kind of a, you know, they couldn't do anything. They were kind of stuck because you didn't have a name, you know, you just had a profile. So when they found GED Match and also a genealogist to work with, the site was an open site, completely open site for them to do the search for any matches or any DNA that had been put into the system that might find D'Angelo. And after he was found and after this last year or so of, you know, catching all kinds of people like the NorCal rapist, they did the same kind of thing to find him. He was right. In Berkeley. And different other perpetrators the last year or so, they've caught, I think, 2018, there were about 30 or more. And 2019 was the biggest year ever of solving cold cases across the United States, and historically, ever. And so it's a great tool. And I was concerned that they would limit what they were allowing, you know, people to do. They would legislate it. They would change the laws so that this would cut down on the ability to find people. And so they did change, GEDmatch itself did change their policy for their customers so that now you have to opt in on their site to be aware that they could use your DNA for purposes of finding criminals, and you can opt in. So people need to know that they can do that. They can say, yeah, sure, go ahead, you know. And so it's just a little safeguard for GEDmatch to make people feel a little more comfortable that people can't do anything with their DNA unless they give permission. And I get that. I understand the privacy issue. But it's going to cut down on how fast they're able to find people, I'm sure. And then also I just saw an article, but I haven't had a chance to sit down and read it. Actually, it was just yesterday or last night about they did change some laws, and I'm not sure what that entails yet. So, and it will cut down on how many people are discovered probably. So
you wrote the book that you thought that. Sorry. When you you wrote in the book that you thought that if there was a connection between East Area Rapist, Golden State Killer, and Zodiac, that would be explored because so many people had that on their mind anyway, and with the DNA, you thought that would be a certainty, and you thought it wouldn't be too long before that kind of announcement. What do you think?
I thought because anybody who knows these crimes and knows California and knows how close geographically everything really is, and that's why I put maps in this book that show exactly how close everything really is, Santa Rosa to Vallejo and Vallejo to San Francisco and so on, that if they think about these crimes in geographically, that he really had the opportunity to be in those areas and kid getaway, that it's really something to consider. The thing is that there are a couple of camps when it comes to Zodiac. There's some people who I don't think really want it to be solved because it's sort of a myth and a mystery. There are other people who are absolutely adamant that it can't possibly be him because he didn't rape the victims or his MO seemed to them to be so totally different. And I think he did that on purpose, like I said. He was smarter than most and was able to do exactly what he said in his letter as he left, was to just sort of change it up and not announce what he was doing. And he did light fires, and he did, you know, break into houses, and he did all this other stuff too. And so he was aware of what he had to do to sort of become a different persona. And that's, you know, some people out there really believe what I believe, that it's a possibility and that it could be him, and I say in the book that I do think it's him, and that's based on all the details of reading the witness statements and the police reports and just really investigating like crazy to try to figure out, you know, if it really could be him. So, but as far as changing MO, you know, people really are pretty rigid sometimes in how they think, and this guy in particular... I referred to this episode of Dexter in my last book where the reality was is the criminal was the criminalist. He was the blood spatter expert on Dexter, if anybody knows that show. And what happens is he sends them a manifesto that includes all this different stuff to try to confuse them. And everybody in law enforcement's reading this, and they all come out with different conclusions about who it could be. I mean, some people thought that the Zodiac was the Unabomber. They all have their suspect that they really think is really the guy. And that's fine. I mean, it'd be great to solve it one way or the other. But when what he does is he tries to make them run around in circles and chase their tails, and he's very effective at that. And that's what D'Angelo was very effective at. So people who don't think there's any way that it could be him, the reality is it really could be him. And like I said, we can place him there in time and geography, as well as some of the things he said, some of the things he did. It's real consistent if you really look at it.
Was there a commonality that you discovered between East Area Rapists' seemingly fascination with wanting to dominate couples and the order of the abuse, like you say, the women more so than the man, but the man would go first. Is there commonalities between the Zodiac and East Area Rapist in terms of regards to couples and his hatred for
yes.
him, seemingly?
Yeah. He did it basically in the same order, in the same way, tied them up the same way. You know, it was classic what he did in the murders at in Dana Point and other couples that he murdered in the 1979 to 1986. The way he tied them, basically hog-tied them. You know, it's all basically the same way that he did it. Some of the things he said while he was doing things, the fact that he left wallets and said he was just there for money and he was going to go to Mexico and just different things like that. And there's a lot more other detail that connects him circumstantially. So, yeah, it's
you provide similar. You provide some interesting photos, too, of D'Angelo and then put a side-by-side with a composites. It's very interesting
uh-huh.
when you see that in that context. Very interesting what you've included there.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, some of that came from the same gentleman that researched this as well, the articles and the different things that came up and the composites that he was able to find. Anyway, it was interesting how we investigated it because we started in a particular place and ended up coming at it from a completely different direction and then did find connections. And I was probably, and like I said, when I started this book, this is not where I was going with it. This was not what was in my mm-hmm. mind. But to answer your question earlier about D'Angelo and possibly being him, what I thought was, when they started to figure out his history and kind of track it, and then I also heard they were testing or trying to test DNA from a stamp or from an envelope or something else, and I had also heard that they had a partial profile. And so I was kind of waiting in the back of my mind for all that time for them to make some sort of an announcement ruling him either in or out, because D'Angelo was originally, before we knew who he was at all, one of the first avenues I went down was, could this be the same guy? Why did I go down that avenue as I was starting to really look into the East Area Rapist? Well, because it was the geography. And all throughout my books, the geography and, you know, has been an important factor in these cases. And so I looked at the possibility that the East Area Rapist could be the Zodiac way early on, like 5 years ago. And I read The Most Dangerous Game and, you know, how he liked to hunt people and, you know, so on. And then I thought, well, I don't think he's the right age. So, and I really wanted to get onto my investigations for East Area Rapist crimes. So I kind of put
right.
that aside. And always in the back of my mind, I was just like, I wonder. So because of the geography. But then because I thought he was too young to have been the Zodiac, I really was hoping D'Angelo was younger so that he could be punished longer when he was finally caught. I really thought that that they would make an announcement in the last year, you know, and I found out that they really couldn't do that because the DNA was not very good. So here we are.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And like I said, we just kind of played with the idea. For several months, it was sort of like, are we going to solve this or, you know, what's the deal? And we kind of went back and forth and back and forth, and all of us did. And then here we all sort of ended up in the same place, you know, together. So.
Is there any interest by law enforcement in the kinds of, well, not the kinds, the things that you are saying, the information that you do have provided? Do you think they will be interested? Is there some willingness, do you think?
Yes. This is a scary idea to admit to, but yeah, they're interested.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Now, you talked about you talked about Lompoc, California, but what about Lompoc really is so important to this idea that they're one and the same? Tell us.
Well, in 1963... there were murders of couples that began on the beach in that area, at Gaviota Beach and also Imperial Beach, and there's a couple others. and that's in Santa Barbara County. And none of the murders have ever been solved. And quite some time after those murders, when the Zodiac was out running amok, they said, well, gee, we think maybe he did commit the murders pre-Zodiac activity down in that area, and there were murders on the beach. In 1963, 64, 1970, there's just different murders that occurred and different ways that they occurred. Getting shot, stabbed, you know. So, again, it's the same kind of thing with the Zodiac where he shot and stabbed and, you know, different things. So, and they thought, well, gee, maybe he also killed Cherry Jo Bates in 1966. Mm-hmm. And here's one of the things that people really go, well, he couldn't have because he was on that boat and he was on his way to Vietnam or whatever. And the fact is that we can't find him on any roster. He didn't actually go anywhere. From what we can gather, he was not on that boat at that time. So he was available for that murder, and he basically claimed it as the Zodiac. So... So anyway, there's a lot of information, a lot of detail that you just keep looking for something to come up where you can say, oh, it couldn't have been him. It doesn't tie. It doesn't fit. But the fact is that no matter what we looked at as far as how this particular story went, he was available. He was connected to an area. There's evidence that he was connected to a 43-minute drive from those beaches in 1963. So you know, it's sort of like, well, what does the evidence tell you? I didn't make the evidence tell me anything. The evidence just tells you, you know. So.
Yes.
And one of the things, too, I didn't read any books on the subject. I didn't read any blogs on the subject. I didn't read anything because I didn't want anybody else's bias to affect where this story took me, where the investigations took me, and where the evidence took me. And so I had none of that. The things that I read, like I said, were the police reports, the witness statements, the timelines, the geography, and what he said and did.
So. You talk about one county. Is it Santa Barbara County? If it isn't, pardon me, but which county was reluctant to bring up the at first said there wasn't evidence and then was reluctant to give up that evidence till 2013.
It was 2011. And what they did do, what I was told, one of my sources told me, is that Santa Barbara County tried to convince everybody during the East Area Rapist Original Night Stalker series that they had no evidence to test in those murders, that they had nothing. Mm. And this went on from 1981 until 2011. Finally, they said, oh, here, we have some evidence. And so finally they tested it, and they were able to connect in 2011, which is a long ways from the 1980s, the murders of Cherry Domingos and Greg Sanchez to other murders in Southern California. That's how long the families had to wait to know for a fact that it was the same serial killer. And what was the reluctance to give that information and that evidence? So I'm wondering what Santa Barbara County has in evidence now from the 1963 murders, 64, 70, and so on. What evidence do they have? And that's what I ask them in the book is, like, did you test it recently? Can it be tested? Because if there's anything at all that will tell us who this guy is, there's got to be some kind of DNA somewhere or some kind of evidence, like there was a fishing knife left under the bodies of two of the murder victims on the beach. And we know that D'Angelo liked to fish, and he carried a fishing knife. So there's just different things. Like I said, it's all circumstantial. It's in the book. And I didn't expect it to be where it led me. This is, you know, you have to ask, well, does this make sense? Is this really what happened? You know?
Sure.
Or is this close to what happened? Even if it's close to what happened, maybe we can figure it out if we test evidence. So. That's pretty much.
Well, you've provided the circumstantial evidence. You've stated the case for it and the reasoning behind it. So you've laid out your case very, very carefully, meticulously, with all the, and again, the timeline, you've already cleared that. So you've done a lot of work for these people so they can look at that. And then, like you, as you say in the book, it's, you don't have access to the DNA. You're not at a lab to do the testing, but certainly anybody would look at this information unless they could see something that you didn't see from their vantage point. It would be simple to find out the absolute truth once and for all with DNA testing.
You would think. Part of the problem, too, I mean, we have ballistic evidence from a lot of this stuff, too. And
that's right.
The problem with that is, and maybe we could get lucky with it, who knows, but the thing with the ballistics evidence is that the thing that D'Angelo did a lot was steal firearms and then get rid of them so they couldn't be connected to them. The Snelling murder in 1975 in Visalia, that's exactly what he did. He stole a firearm from somebody there in the area, and then he used it against Claude Snelling. And then, of course, that probably got ditched after that. So he was clever in that he continually took firearms and ammunition. But in the very beginning, back in Lompoc, somebody bought ammunition, and he actually inadvertently left it at the scene. So there's ballistics evidence they thought possibly the Zodiac used the same kind of ammunition and weapon from the murders on the beach that day and also the first murders in the Zodiac series. So I'm a little, I'm not as well versed in the types of guns, et cetera, and ballistics, but the descriptions of the gun are interesting because it has a long nose on it. But anyway, it'd just be interesting to see if they really, really diligently went after looking at some of this evidence, what kind of answers would we get? And that's, I also didn't expect to get to that place in my book either, but you know, it begs the questions. Do you have evidence? And if you do, you know, even the ripping of shirts and different materials that were left on bodies, and there was also an instance where someone was strangled with scarf and things like that, where, you know, is this him? Did he do this? Is there a way to find out? You know, and that way we could solve other murders for other families, and that's pretty much the point.
Before I let you go, one of the more interesting things and part of your argument too, or to support your argument, is that the East Area Rapist would use fabric as ties often for his victims, and the Zodiac.
Towels or whatever. Yeah.
Sure. And you say, in support of that, you talk about the Zodiac and Paul Stein and the shirt. Just before I let you go, tell us about Paul Stein and what Zodiac, in your mind, does with this shirt.
Well, I mean, if we can really track it, and we really can't tell you when he began, what he did and all that, but when it comes to the Paul Stein murder, we know that he ripped his shirt. And he took pieces of it to send to law enforcement to prove it was him. And just when I thought about him tearing the shirt, I thought about all the other crimes that were committed later on where he tore towels or there was material found on the backs of Manuela with McEwen and different things that occurred over time where you can see that he was ripping fabric. That happened to some of the East Area Rapist victims too. And I thought, is that when he psychologically became like attached to the ripping of the fabric? Was that something that he enjoyed doing because of what he did in the Paul Stein case? I don't know. But, you know, these are things that I wondered. So.
That's fascinating. I want to thank you very much, Anne. You make an incredible and compelling case for this. What if Golden State Killer, Zodiac solved? For those that might want to look and see your other work, can you tell us about a Facebook page or website, Anne, please?
Well, I can be found on Facebook under Anne Penn. I also have a WordPress site, Anne Penn WordPress. And, the podcast that you and I have done pretty much the only time I've talked to anybody about this. So I appreciate your time with that and always appreciate the interviews.
Well, thank you very much for coming on and sharing with us first What If, Golden State Killer, Zodiac Solved, and Penn. Thank you once again very much. You have a great evening. Hope to talk to you again soon.
You do the same. Yeah, thanks so much, Dan.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you. Good night.